Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, your life connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Integrity in Action, live on Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, monthly on the third Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. This is your opportunity to listen live with host Lois Shulman, empowerment coach, facilitator, and public speaker of Integrity in Action, LLC. She will interview with sensitivity, unconditional love, and without judgment individuals who have chosen to exemplify the highest levels of ethical principles, sound moral character, and honesty. Each month, the featured guests will share their story. These interviews will give listeners an opportunity to feel the passion and emotion of the person being interviewed, as well as inspire listeners to entertain a new perspective from which to expand their own understanding. When this occurs, we move beyond the limitations of our current thinking to heal and become more aware, awake, and expansive. And now I give you your host, Lois Shulman.
We're sitting in a beautiful library in a community that is small but yet part of a greater community. And I'm here tonight with a wonderful man, a lovely man, who I met at the place that he works and a place that I frequent. And my impression of Morris at the time that I met him was that he was a thoughtful, introspective, and deliberate man in search of a life of internal peace. Morris impressed me as a man of integrity. I arrived at these observations from the way in which that Morris spoke to me, the way in which he shared his story, the way in which he smiled at me, and the way in which he was willing to better himself and striving to be the best person that he could be. So I want to ask Morris. Morris has had a life of challenges, as we all have experienced, and he has used his challenges in order to better himself. And I want to ask Morris, at the time when he was going through his most difficult challenges, and maybe Morris will give us some background as to what those challenges were in your life, how you then began your journey to come out to be the best person that you could be.
Well, thank you, Lois, for asking me to do this. I grew up in Texas, where high school football is king. My dad was a college football All-American, wide receiver at Kirby Indian University. So football was a major part of my growing up as a young man. Guys at that time could play sandlot football and pick up football. So sports was real big, real big. I played football. I was second-team All-American in Texas high school. I was selected to the Texas All-Star football game. And it was that game, fourth quarter of that football game. It was the first high school playoffs, or All-Star games, I should say, that took place in the new Dallas Cowboys Stadium at the time. And with a minute and 11 seconds left in the game, I broke my leg making a tackle, which resulted in a compound fracture of two bones in my left leg. Now, this wasn't part of the script. The script that I had envisioned was that I signed to play football at Kirby Indian University, my dad's and my mother's alma mater. And I was going to play football. My major at the time was animal science. And play football, make All-American, get drafted, come back in the off season and finish my degree, apply for veterinary school, and play pro football, and off season come back, continue my studies in animal science, or veterinary medicine, and eventually get a degree as a veterinarian, and eventually retire from pro football and open up a large animal clinic, vet clinic, concentrating on animals with horses and cows. So I was a cowboy. As a kid growing up, we were involved in 4-H and FFA. My dad had about 20 black Angus cattle. His major was agriculture as well.
Yeah.
And before integration, he taught agriculture at the black school and the black high school. And my mom was the only economics teacher at the same high school. So that was, well, my older sister was in 4-H, same as I was. And so we were yearly exhibitors in the Brazoria County Fair, which at that time was the largest county fair in the state of Texas. I think 7 years old, I had my first grand champion, which was a pen of flyers, chickens. And my dad started buying cows, Angus. And he loved Angus. And so it was a big deal. We would get up every morning. We had to be out of the house at 5 a.m. in the morning. And we lived out in the country. And there would be no one else's. No one else would have lights on other than us.
Did the rooster wake you?
Sometimes. Usually the rooster was my dad getting us out. And my sister and I would go out every morning. And we would feed and water our steers for the county fair, and we had one lot of our pasture that I guess was about 3 acres, 4 acres, that we had to exercise our steers, walk them around it twice. So every morning we would get up and we would do this and come back in, take our baths. My mom would have breakfast, and we rode to school with them, so there was no, you know, rush getting to school. So this was our morning, and then come October, when the first week of October was when the county fair was. And so we would exhibit what they called fat steers at that time, along with Angus cows or heifers, for breeding beef show, as they call it. And so my dad thought that we had some of the best Angus in the state. And so we exhibited in a Missouri County Livestock Show, Houston Livestock Show, San Antonio, and Dallas. And he was very proud of his Angus. And as I said, he always thought that he could compete.
Was the purpose of raising them to sell them for consumption?
At that time, we lived in segregated Texas. To sell them for consumption as consumption was one, but also so my mom would not have to suffer the indignity of going to the grocery store and listening to some of the derogatory things that were said. He also was one of the things that at that time we had the Brazoria County Fair, but everything was segregated. So you had a Negro division, and then you had a white division. And my sister had won grand champion. I've won grand champion several times. But yet and still, we could not, our calves would be in the auction, but they would never be sold. White bidders would not bid on our livestock.
What year was this?
I would say 1964, 66.
Oh, my gosh, I have no idea.
I think it was 1967, Texas was forced by the federal government to accept Brown versus Board.
Mm-hmm.
So in accepting that, they shut down Charlie Brown High School and Elementary, which is where my parents worked. And they only took two teachers, one high school teacher and one elementary teacher from that. And so both my parents had to find work elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
My dad went and worked with the Ag Department and Agriculture Department at D.C. for a year, a little over a year and a half. And then my mom worked at Powell Point High School in Kimmelton, Texas, which was not far from where we lived. But it was a strain on us because my dad was away.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom was left there trying to juggle taking care of us, working, and I mean, she had to travel like 35 miles round trip, back and forth. So it was tough on her, and my dad eventually came back from D.C., took a job teaching at a vocational center, and we were immersed into the white middle school and high school, and I've always had an easy time meeting people, which is the nature. I mean, we lived in the country, but the guy across the street from me, the nights, they were white. The closest house next to us, which was maybe a quarter of a mile at one point, was a white family. At one point, we were the only black family that lived out of this part of the country. And we were one of the few black kids that were in 4-H. My mom started her own 4-H club because we were not allowed to be part of the white 4-H clubs. She called it the Busy Bee. And so we would be out every morning, and my dad made sure. I mean, I had to clean out the calf pen, throw hay. My sister knows how to. She's well-versed in cleaning out a calf pen, handling livestock. I have two sisters, and one older and one younger, and we all were in 4-H. All of us were in 4-H.
So when your dad went away, did he keep the beat?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And your mother had to run that with you,
mm-hmm.
three children?
Yes, yes.
So this football of yours was a dream.
Well, not so much a dream. It was, everyone's heard of the TV show Friday Night Lights, which talks about Texas football, how big it was. Well, the thing about my high school was that from the time I got into middle school, we were in the playoffs. I mean, we went deep into the Texas high school football playoffs. We were well recruited by universities throughout Texas. So seventh grade, I wanted to play football. Eighth grade, I wanted to play football because I want to be part of those championship teams. And we would have, I had the Knights who lived across the street from me. Coach Brand, who was my defensive coach, lived about almost 3 miles, 4 miles down the road past where we live. On any given Friday or Saturday afternoon, they would pick me up walking from town or running from town. And it was just a matter of something to do. It's 4,000 people, my hometown, and it's still 4,000 people. But football was big, and you wanted to be part of the football team.
So were you always a young
kid.
Man?
Yeah, I was a big kid. I was a big kid, bigger than most of the guys in my class. And I was always strong. As I say, we threw hay and picked up bales of hay and feed sacks and things like that, so I was naturally strong. And so when I became a freshman in high school, I wanted to be on the varsity team. But because there were others better than me, I had to be on the junior varsity or the freshman team. And once I became a sophomore, I went out for track. And I threw the shot put in discus in track and lettered in track. I had my letterman's jacket, which is a cool thing. And I knew that by lettering, they had to consider me for varsity. So they did. And I was second string, which was not good enough. And I guess toward the end of my sophomore year, I was being in and out of the lineup of first string. And by my junior year, I was first string, all county, senior all county, honorable mention all state, this sort of thing, my junior year. And I started to, I lived a mile and a half outside of town. I wanted a horse. My dad bought a horse, quarter horse. There is the quarter horse mare. And I wanted to start trying to rodeo. So these are things that just I wanted to do. My parents were always encouraging us to do things. Anything that we have achieved is because of our parents. My mom and dad were, at the time, my grandmother on my dad's side graduated from Philander Smith College with a degree in domestic science in 1914.
Oh, my gosh.
And my grandmother on my mom's side was a teacher at Texas College, an English teacher. So education was very big in our family. My dad's oldest brother was at Tuskegee Airmen. He was at graduate of Wiley College. My dad was the only one that didn't go to Wiley College. He comes from six brothers and one sister. All of them went to Wiley College except for my dad. He went to Prairie View A&M University, where he was All-American football player and majored in master's degree in agriculture. So football was the thing. Football was the thing. But I found this other thing that I like to do. It's called rodeo. And there's a picture of me. I mean, because I was one of the few kids, black kids at that time, I liked the idea of wearing the hat and the boots and all this. And so I started rodeoing, and I belonged to the Texas Youth Rodeo Association. And I wasn't good at it as I was in football, but I liked the whole idea of trying. And so I would go to rodeos, and I'd have my chaps, and my mom made me a pair of chaps with the fringe on. They were gray and black and had my initials on. initials on them, and I had bareback rigging. That
you had what?
What they call a bareback rigging for riding wild Bronx. And then I had a bull rope because I used to bull ride and bareback ride and steer dog. And my dad used to always say, man, you're going to get hurt. The coaches would, like, he's going to get hurt doing this, and that's going to be the end of his football career. And the local newspaper down there came and did a story on me doing being a rodeo guy and playing football, which was pretty cool stuff. And to this day, I love rodeo. I love horses and that whole aspect. But and then once my dad, I was driving when I was 12, because this country driving a truck around on the farm and this sort of thing. So my dad allowed me to drive to a rodeo, and I was 16, 17, 16, and I took my horse, the trailer, and everything. And the rodeo was about 35 miles away from our house. And I didn't find, what I'm telling you now, I did not find out until the Christmas of 2001, or maybe 1999. And my dad was telling me the story. I had no idea what I'm going to tell you. So I took my horse to the rodeo, and it's late at night. I guess my dad expected me to be home at a certain time. It's past 10 o'clock. So he got in my mom's car, and he had driven to where the rodeo was. And he saw the trailer. He saw where the horse was tied up, and he saw that there was feed there, and he saw other parents there at the rodeo. And he got in and figured I was okay. So he got in the car and came home. Now, I did not know this. I did not know he had even come to check on me. Well, I think it was 1995 or 2000. But that made me feel pretty good once I heard the story, that he trusted me enough that he didn't feel as though he had to check on me. And a lot of times I was just a kid. I mean, I was just a guy. It's not like I was this black guy. I was just a guy. So there was this one guy, I put this in the story, that his name was Blaine Koontz. And Blaine Koontz, I did not know him. I did not know who he was. But I would be at a rodeo, and as I said, a lot of times I was the only black guy there. And this guy would, pull your bull rope for you, assist you in getting on the bull and all this sort of thing. And he didn't go, hey, can I help you, or anything like that. He just started doing it. And we were same age. And it was just like, I got to the point that when I showed up at the rodeo, I looked for him. And we just sort of just gravitated together and just started hanging out together. And I don't know why. It just happened that way. It just happened. Blaine Koontz was that guy. And I don't know his dad. His dad was a high school football coach and come from a good family. Fast forward, Lynn Hay, who's a classmate of mine, she and I connected on Facebook. So I said, well, Lynn, this was maybe 5 years ago. I said, Lynn, what are you doing? You know, where are you? And she had moved to Lake Jackson, Texas, or Clute, I should say, Clute, Texas, which is not far from where we grew up, and she was married. I said, well, who did you marry? She goes, a guy named Blaine. I said, Blaine?
Oh, my
God. I said, Blaine who? She goes, Blaine Koontz. I said, whoa, wait a minute. You married Blaine Koontz, the rodeo guy? Did you suppose? She goes, yeah. So I found a photograph of him standing behind the bucking chutes and me riding a bull. He just pulled my rope. And I sent it to her. I said, is this the guy that you married? She goes, yes. And you're talking about a small world. I had no idea. And I shared with Lynn a couple years ago that, I don't know if Blaine ever told you this. I said, but he came into my life at a time when I was the only one. He didn't have to. He became a friend of mine because he didn't have to. Excuse me. But he,
beautiful that you're feeling this emotion at this time.
Well, he reached out to me at a time that a lot of other people did not.
Yeah.
And he'll always have a place in my heart because of that. And I shared this with Lynn. I said, I just want you to know how special the man that you married is. He may not know what he did and how much it meant to me at the time, right now, but I just want you to know this. So
Have you ever had the honor of sharing with them directly?
No, I did not.
You will.
This was, as I say, I sent this to Ann over private messenger, and I don't know why. I just, one night, I think she had responded to a Facebook or something, or blatantly put something on it. Now, this guy is multifaceted, multi-talented. He can build anything. He took a 52 hubcap on a Ford car and made a guitar out of it. He restored an old-fashioned Coke machine that you'd have, the red and white four Coke machines.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful guy. And so, I went my way. He went his way after high school, after rodeo. And I, you know, it's just a memory, a photograph, a black and white photograph of him. And for her to say this is who she married, being and I were classmates. Ben and I was classmates. My mom, I think, may have taught her home economics. So it was just really, I thought I had to share it with her.
Yeah.
To this day, I don't know if she told him or not, but that was very important that he reached out to me and befriended me. And Rodeo said he would not be in attendance. I would miss him. I would miss just hanging out, not doing anything, especially we were young guys whose parents felt like, well, they can't do too much damage. I mean, growing up in little small towns like that, everybody knows who you are, from the police chief, police on the staff, to the judge and everybody else. So if you stepped out of line, there are a lot of people there that would make sure that they put you back in line. I had Coles that they're there he's passed on now, but he was inducted into the Texas Rodeo Cowboy Hall of Fame. His father treated me like he had three sons, and his middle son and I were thick as thieves. And his mother worked, Richard's mom, his name is Richard. There were three sons with Richard, Larry, and Mike, and they had one sister named Linda. Well, Mrs. Cole was a cook at the school, and they knew who I was because I played football. They knew who my parents were because my mom taught at the school. But she never hesitated. She felt I was doing something wrong to correct me. Not like, I'm going to tell your mom, but she would correct me. I mean, I was in and out of her house, I don't know how many times during growing up in high school, I stopped coming to see her. And my mom, Mrs. Cole asked my dad, where's Morris? I think I joined the Navy at that time. And my dad told her, well, he hasn't been home to see me. You tell him when he comes home, he needs to stop by the house. And one particular time I came home, and she and his name was Ed Cole, we called him Mr. Ed. They were going to church. And she goes, Morris, the refrigerator, we have sandwiches and stuff like that in the refrigerator. I'll tell Richard that you're here. I'll make yourself at home. And he left me there at the house. And so Richard comes up. I'm sitting there watching TV. And she never allowed us to drink at the house. I will say that. We came home drunk many times, but she never allowed us to drink at the house. And I, to this day, there was beer in the refrigerator. I don't think I've ever had a beer at her house, just out of respect for her and Mr. Cole. So
with all this great upbringing in a small town and all this love and support, and I see, based on the emotion that you show when you talk about your upbringing, what went through your head at that moment of that injury on the football field?
Well, it was funny. Fourth quarter, as it was a minute and 11 seconds left in the game, and I made the tackle. And it was before they changed the rule to where what they call a crack back block had to be above the waist. So I was on the bottom of the pile because the floor of the play was coming. I was playing on the left defensive end. And so the floor of the play was coming toward my side of the field. So I made the tackle. Well, the guys on the right side was following the floor of the play. So when I made the tackle, they all piled on, causing me to be on the very bottom of the pile. Well, we were playing on AstroTurf, so my foot went like this and just snapped. And it snapped both bones. I had a hole in my leg, just like this. And so my left foot literally then everybody, got untangled, and Wilson Whitley, who was playing defensive tackle, says, "Marks, get up." Now, Wilson went to play at Brenham High School. He and I have been going against each other all year from freshman year through senior. And he goes, "Marks, get up." I said, I can't move. He goes, "Get up." I said, "I cannot move." And he goes, "Oh, my God, his leg is broke. His leg is broken." And he just starts screaming, "His leg is broke. His leg is broke."
Did you feel pain in it?
Did not feel any pain at all until they brought him out. Now, I told my mom and dad, I've always told my mom, I said, "Now, if I ever get hurt," because I finally got him to come see me at a rodeo, and I had this big old boy, threw me down and hit me in the head. I always told my mom, because she was like, "Oh, my gosh," she tried to tell my dad, "Go down and see if he's okay." And I said, "If I ever get hurt, do not come down going, 'Oh, my baby.' Do not come running down the field going, 'Oh, my baby.'" So she's telling me that she told my dad, she was Morris, and I'm named after my father. So if you hear me refer to Morris, that's who I'm talking about. He is Morris Earl Richardson, Sr. I'm Morris Earl Richardson, Jr., although I changed it to the second. That's a whole other story. But anyway, so I'm laying there, and I'm not feeling anything. And so they bring the stretcher out, and then they take it back, and then they bring it out again, and they bring the ambulance up. Well, it wasn't until they put it in slow, pulling my leg down to put it in an air cast, that I began to feel the pain. Excuse me. And so they put me in the ambulance and put a tongue depressor, it's like wrapped in gauze, about 6 inches long and about 2 inches in diameter in my mouth, and have me bite on that. And took me to Baylor Hospital there in Dallas. And so I'm waiting. I got on my shoulder pads and my...
Well, wait. Why'd they have you bite? They didn't give you anything to take your pain?
No, the hole was so big you could put, I'm a big guy, I could put both my fists in the hole. That's how big it was.
In the hole you mean?
The hole on my leg, yes. Oh, it was just dangling off. So they were afraid to put any, give me anything because they weren't sure as to what. So I get to the hospital. The nurse comes out. She goes, "Well, sir, how did you injure yourself?" And I'm laying there with football pads on and everything. And so as about to wheel me in the OR, my dad is standing there. I said, "And you thought I was going to get hurt rodeo?" So every Sunday, I would always go to church. I was baptized in Israel Chapel, AME Church, African Methodist Church. But I would always go to a church, be it either Blue Run Baptist or Israel Chapel or our sister church down in Mound Creek, which is not far from where I grew up. So the thing that I was laying there with the following morning or later on after I came out of the OR was, why me? And I'm talking to God, I'm doing all the things that you say, at least I thought. And if you believe in that, but why me? Why did this happen? This is not part of the script. Why me? And I mean, I remember the doctor telling me as he's pulling me in and he's looking at the injury, he goes, "You never get to play football ever again." And I was just like, crestfallen. I had no idea. I woke up that morning. I had a triangle right in front of me to pull myself up. I had a cast up to my hip. It had a window in it to where they could actually open it up, and my leg was, how much is that, you think, in terms of space?
3 inches.
3 inches? 3 inches. They left that much of a gap. They used 150-pound fishing test wire, the wire, to stitch it. I had 25 screws in my leg from the top of my ankle all the way up to almost my knee. And every morning they would come in, they would squeeze the pus and blood out of that every morning because they couldn't close the cast. And I laid there and I was just really, and I mean, I sunk into a very, very deep depression. This was not supposed to happen to me. Not at all. So what was I, 6 weeks in the hospital, I think. Finally, I was in Dallas, and then they transferred me to Houston, which is close because we live 50 miles south of Houston. And I was on crutches, and I hated everyone. I was mad at God. No one could talk to me because I was just so angry. This was not supposed to happen. It just wasn't supposed to happen. Everyone knew it was announced on sports that night. The South lost the valuable player with Marsh Richardson, who broke his leg with a minute and 11 seconds left in the game.
Did you have to keep hearing that you were never going to play again?
I only heard it once, and that was enough. Purdue honored the scholarship. I did not play my freshman year. I did not play my sophomore year. I was just not in a good place. And ended up I wasn't going to class. I wasn't doing what I needed to do. And my grades, I got put on academic probation. And so I met a young lady named Sonia Fair, who was a campus photographer for the newspaper, The Panther. That was a college newspaper, The Panther. And I was more interested in her than in photography. But I was a member at that time of the Methodist Student Movement. And so I think she came to take a picture for something. But anyway, I started talking to her about the camera. And so she, being a good sport, you know, showed me how to use it. And when she wasn't using it, she allowed me to go out and take pictures and that sort of thing. Well, the campus photographer for the president, his name is Tom, I forget his last name. Well, he took me into a dark room and showed me how to process film and showed me how to bring up black and white print in the tray. And I thought it was just magic. I was just like, oh, my God. Right. I was no longer interested in agriculture. My major, as I said, was animal science. I hadn't come to grips as to why this injury had happened to me. I just didn't know. I couldn't understand why. There was no one there giving me any answers. There was no one there. Nor was I asking why. And so I just immersed myself into taking pictures, learning about this camera, and people began to associate me with the camera. Sonia didn't come back the following semester. She was from Lubbock, Texas, so I think she went to school there. So I started taking pictures for the newspaper on campus. And the dean of men at Purview and my father, not only were they former teammates, but they were also homeboys.
What does that mean?
They from the same hometown, same community, went to the same high school. And so I had so many eyes on me at Purview because, as I said, my mom and dad's alma mater. I didn't go in there from the time I was old enough to walk. We would go there every homecoming. We did not miss a homecoming. We did not miss the conference track meet. My dad was one of the timers at the conference track meet. And so his friends had kids our age, so it was like a whole herd of little kids running around, became preteens, became teens, became young adults, that once we got to Purview, for homecoming, it was never about, well, where are they? It was like, well, someone, we're going to be going over to the Wallace's house, or we're going to be going over to the Stafford's house. Someone will make sure all the kids got to where all the parents were. So Purview was in my life early on, early on. So Dean Marion, as I said, was a dean of men, and my dad were classmates, and he was basically keeping an eye on me. I do believe that. But he told my dad, he goes, you know, Morris is pretty good at this part. And as I mentioned earlier, both my parents were big on education. So we looked at schools of photography, and one of the things we looked at was the United States Navy, the United States Air Force, the University of Mexico in Mexico City had a good photography program. My dad's oldest brother, who I mentioned was a Tuskegee Airman, he was also, I guess you'd call him an expatriate at that time. He had been blacklisted and he left the United States in 1954 and moved to Mexico City and became a linguist. He taught American corporate people Spanish and Spanish corporate English. Plus, he also would have frequent acting roles with Simpson Floss. He was a Mexican comedian. I would say one thing about him was every Saturday he was he played an African chief in the old Tarzan movies with Ron Eli, and also was part of the National Negro Theater with Paul Robeson. So that was the Mexico connection and Germain School of Photography in Rochester Institute. So being that I'm nothing, no Spanish other than que pasa, I didn't want to go to Mexico. And so I chose to Germain School of Photography. Now, football is still in my blood. Still in my blood. I was doing all types of crazy stuff. But I would stop it and get in shape. And I would go down to the Jets training camp, and I would be just someone on the sideline looking, thinking, you know, why me? Why did this happen to me? Because everyone that I played with in that All-Star game went on to get drafted. Wilson Whitley, who was going, get up, Morris, get up. He got drafted by Cincinnati Bengals. Bell Belcher, who was our offensive guard, he got drafted by Tampa Bay. No, St. Louis Cardinals. Randy Gertes, who was our tight end, he got drafted by Tampa Bay. Billy Waddy, wide receiver, got drafted by the Rams. So I was in good company, and I knew that I had the stuff to make it work for me as well, but I just had the misfortune that it didn't happen for me. My leg was broken. So
So how did you make the?
Well, it was a long, long walk. It was a long walk. I was angry for a long time. Because I didn't have any answers as to why. As I said, I would go to church, and I felt that that was part of the scenario, that you go to church and you do all the good things. I mean, I wasn't doing bad stuff. I was tame compared to some of the stuff guys do, you know. But why? Why was this happening to me? The struggle was, why was this happening to me? I didn't want to be around anyone. So after my freshman year at Germain, I joined the Navy as a photographer, because that was one of the places we had looked at, and had a lot of success. I ended up being stationed at NATO headquarters, Supreme Allied Command, for 3 years while I was there. I was a member of the Navy Combat Camera, and got so much training from as far as photography was concerned. But I did karate and all that sort of thing, but I still had that inkling to play football. And it was just a drive just to see if I could make it. So when I told my dad I was getting out, he arranged for a trial with the Dallas Cowboys. And I made it almost to the final cut. And shortly after that, I guess about a month later, I had a tryout with the Houston Oilers at the time, and it was just like, okay, I got cut immediately, and my head probably wasn't in it. So I was just like, you know what, it's time for you to do something else. It's time for you. If you're going to be a photographer, you need to pursue that. And at that time, the USFL, United States Football League, was forming, and my mom begged me. She goes, Marsh, why don't you just give it one more try? Why don't you try out for the Houston Texans? Like, no, it's time for me to do something else. Now, I had a guy that I met in the Navy that was Muslim, and he was just like, man, you need to find inner peace with yourself. I was like, you talk about it. He goes, you got a lot of anger, and it's because you haven't talked to yourself. You don't talk to yourself. You may have a conversation, but you don't really talk to yourself. I was like, yeah, but. So I continued Navy, did it for 8 years, and got out, pursued photography. And then I started thinking about, you know, let's put some things in perspective. You're not going to play football. That's done. So you can't continue to beat yourself up over something that you gave it a shot. It didn't happen for you. So it's done. The hard part was that being a photojournalist, especially working for newspapers, I had to cover football, and I had to cover pro football. And a lot of times when I covered pro football, I saw guys that I played with. So that kept bringing that back to the forefront, And Oilers would play the Rams, or Oilers would play, I knew Earl Campbell would play for the Oilers, and Robert Brazil would play for the Oilers, and several other guys, and I'd see them, and it was just, Mark, come on, man. So you can't continue to live like this. You have to get a grip. And so I was always interested in religion. And so I saw this blurb. At the time, I was working for Baylor College of Medicine as a photographer. And I saw a thing in the newspaper about, let's talk about race. I think that's what it says. come to the healing Center for the Healing of Racism. So go ahead. So go check it out. And they're talking about people sharing, I mean, some of the most horrific stories in their lives that have to do with race. And so I thought that was pretty cool. And I met a young lady there named Olga Rodriguez. She was Catholic, and she and I kept attending. And I met several other people and kept attending. And I was like, okay, I've never been with an organization that's talking about race. And we're talking about, here are the guidelines we're going to share tonight, you know, and people would stand up voluntarily, just stand up and talk about it. And so finally, I guess after my second year of doing this, we would have these meetings at what they call the Baha'i Center. I was like, what's a Baha'i?
Yeah.
What is a Baha'i? And so they never talked about the faith, never talked about the faith. And so they said they were going to have a seekers meeting, and it was going to be at someone's house. And I went there, and I mean, I had dated white women before, and Olga and I was dating, she was Mexican American. And so interracial dating was not something that was new to me. It was old hat, but I saw quite a few interracial people at this meeting. And they talked about the Baha'i faith and how they believe in the oneness of mankind, and that we're all of one. We all come from one God. And it just got me to thinking, and I went back another year for the Institute of Healing and Racism. And I started studying the Baha'i faith, and it started giving me some clarity. And I started looking deeper within myself as to where you are, what are you trying to achieve, you know, and it started knocking some of that anger out of me. And in doing that, I talked to people and processed, they offered some insight as to things, and people would send me different quotes from Baha'i writings, different quotes from Rumi, and just sharing a lot of experiences that some were not as bad as mine, and then some was horrible. And those that were horrible, I'm thinking, why are you stuck where you are? Look at what this person has gone through. And look at you. Look at you. You are walking around and with this big cloud over you, and you're feeling sorry for yourself. But you're here for a reason. God has brought you this far for a reason. And then, at the time, I was still doing photography. I was working for, I'd been working for the Baylor College of Medicine, but I had this photojournalism bug, so I quit there and I started working for the Houston Defender, a black weekly newspaper, that was the leading black weekly newspaper in Houston. And I was covering everything. I met Congressman Nikki Leland, who had taken over Congresswoman Barbara Jordan's spot, congressional seat. And also was doing things for Jet Magazine. I'd send Jet Magazine pictures just on a fluke, and then I started getting paid. And then one night, L. Franco Lee, who's a commissioner, decided that he was going to run for commissioner's seat. He'd been an alternate. And I got a photograph of him hugging a supporter, and a tear came down. You could see the tear clearly.
Oh,
and I sent it to Jet Magazine, and they ran it on the international page. I was just like excited. I went and sent it to my mom. I started getting assignments from them, and other things came, and I'm still doing the Baha'i thing, and I'm feeling good about myself. But I always had that doubt that I was not good enough, that I was not. My dad wanted me to do something else. He didn't have faith in this photography thing. And it mattered a lot to me about what he thought, a whole lot, even now, about what he thought. I question myself now, especially if I'm doing something that I know he would not approve of. I always step back and I question that. Even after I may have done it, I may beat myself up for a while. And, your dad, your parents won't approve of this. So
it sounds like that finding of inner peace was a big turning point, at least allowing you to go forward.
Oh, huge, because I was stuck. It was a huge motivation for me to go forward. Just listening to others and knowing that you're not by yourself in terms of having life-altering things happen to you. You have a choice. You either stay where you are, Mars, and constantly dwell on things that should have been, could have been, or you decide to move forward. No one can come and go, Mars, you should do this. Yeah, they can say that. But until you make up your mind to do this, you're going to continue to just dwell right there. It's like you're going to be just a tire stuck in mud, just roll. And so it was after the first Challenger accident happened, and I went out to NASA, and President Reagan was coming. And they had this big flatbed truck set up, and I put my tripod up there, and I put on some duct tape, Ebony Jet magazine, and it's rooted on there. And then I went, they had a meeting for photographers that were going to be in the pool. Meeting lasted maybe half an hour. Came back, and I see this man standing with his camera mounted on my tripod. I was like, excuse me. that's my tripod. He goes, I know. It said Ebony Jet there. He goes, my name is Michael Cheers, D. Michael Cheers, D, the letter D, period, Michael Cheers. He was the regional photographer for Jet Magazine. He covered D.C. and all the way over to Arizona. And he goes, well, you just come from the pool meeting, right? I said, yeah. He goes, well, go back up there. And so he and I began to cross paths. When he big stories would come, I mean, we photographed for Mandela when he came here, Bishop, when he came to Houston, when Bishop Tutu came to accept the Rothko Chapel Peace Award. I photographed him for Jet Magazine, and he was there for Ebony Magazine. When President Mandela came, same thing for the Rothko Chapel Peace Award. I was a point photographer for the magazine when Congressman Leland died on his welfare mission to Ethiopian refugees. And so one day, Mike and I were covering something, not a big story, and he goes, I recommended you for something. I was like, wow, what? He goes, you'll find out. And one of the problems I was having in Houston, I did everything that I was told I had to do when I got out of the Navy. If you want to work for a newspaper, a major newspaper, you need to do an internship. You need to work at a smaller daily. And I kept being denied. I interned at the Houston Post. Eventually, Houston Post went out of business. And I kept applying, and I kept applying to the Houston Chronicle, which was the only surviving newspaper in Houston. It's still, actually. And I could never get hired. There would always be someone else that they could hire before me, but they would never hire me. Never. I was like everybody else who wanted to come and work for their hometown newspaper, but I think that was a wrong complexion. Because one of the photographers, Mars, he'll never hire you. You know that, right? I was like, no, I did not know that, but that was why. And so continue to photograph, and I receive this letter in the mail saying that you've been selected as one of 50 African Americans to work on the football songs of my people. You need to be in Washington, D.C. at the Cochran Gallery on such and such a date, 1991. And so I was like, okay. So I showed my mom, and she was like, she had no idea what it was. My dad had no idea what it was. And so he goes, you're just going to quit your job? And I said, absolutely. So I may have saved maybe $500. And I flew to D.C. And I saw photographers that I used to be in the Navy with. I saw photographers that I'd only seen at Byline, that worked for Newsweek, was a big magazine at that time. And Garden Parks was there. And I was just like, I'm not worthy. So I'm saying all this. The assignment they gave me was blacks in the military. So they sent me to Cheyenne, Wyoming, to F.E. Warren Air Base. Apparently, because of segregation, blacks had not been allowed to serve there until Sammy Davis came through the U.S. OSHA with Bob Hope or something like that, back in the mid-60s or something like that. So anyway, I photographed a mine that was in the book for the female photographer, African-American woman, sitting in the helicopter preparing to take off. We got the camera in the foreground, and she's sitting there. So we had a big reception at the Cochran, and who's who among black Americans there, from Reverend Jackson, who was hot at that time, to Mary Cloud Bethune to Mary Wright Elderman, you name it, they were there. And asking for autographs, taking photographs. And again, I didn't feel as though I belonged. And my sister told me, goes, but you are there. You are there. And I was still in the back of my mind dealing with the whole, why did it happen to make that? And so they asked me to say a prayer before we adjourned to go to our different destinations to photograph. And so a couple of guys said Christian prayers, and I got up and I said a Bible prayer. And I don't know what it was about that prayer. Is there any removal of difficulty? Say God. Say praise be God. He is God. All of it, all of his servants and all of God by his bidding. And that was it. That was a prayer. And we went our separate ways. And I got a phone call saying that the Today Show wants to interview you while you're there. So Katie Kirk comes and she interviews me, and I'm on the Today Show. And this is Katie Kirk and Brian Kumble. And it was just, it just seemed like that was just the walk, the closer, you know, the song, Closer Walk With Thee. It seemed as though I was just walking in the light. I was doing stuff. I was not dwelling on it, and that's what I needed to just continue to walk with that. And I'm not trying to come up as like I'm this holy religious guy, but it helped me. And when I got down, I would just not so much read a scripture or anything like that, but I would just think about something that I ran in on, some verse and so on. I kept pushing myself. I kept pushing myself that only way you're going to get whatever it is that you see at the end of the rainbow, or think that's at the end of the rainbow, is that you have to push yourself. No one's going to give it to you if you have to push yourself. So, I mean, I've been applying for positions. And my daddy goes, Marsh, you've applied for every newspaper in the country. It's time for you to do something else. He says, you should just give up. And I got a freelance job from the Kansas City Star to go cover the Midwest Regional Ballroom Dance thing. And from that, I met someone that worked for United Press International. And I was just like, wow, something was going on. I don't know who's in charge. I know I'm not. I'm just out there just trying to do the very best I can. And finally, I just stopped dwelling on it. I just really, really stopped dwelling on it. And then it was 2003, my mom found out that she had lung cancer. And both of them were smokers, she met my dad. And the last I saw her was, she had been, they had let her out of the hospital, and we were going to let her, she was going to stay with my sister in case she had to go back for a checkup. And her breathing was very difficult. They had this hose with this air respirator that went all around my sister's house so she could walk in. It just outfitted her with a portable air oxygen tank. And that was 2003. She passed away about, I was working in Little Rock, Arkansas, the newspaper. And they told me that you need to come up here. You need to come down to Texas. And I left. And she was basically dead. When she was having difficult breathing, I was there, and she was crying, and I said, Mom, it's going to be okay. And I had to talk about it. And so the last I saw her was sitting in my sister's car. It was going to take her to the hospital. When I came back, she was on the respirator, and the doctor told me that she was very comfortable. She had no idea I was there. And again, I said a high prayer. I had my prayer book. And just sat with it, and I read several prayers. I don't want in particular, just a lot of prayers. That was hard. My mom was, she's everything. So, she passed on, and I just realized that a lot of stuff that I was going through was not, was minuscule compared to other things. I mean, I witness a guy saying that he lost his daughter because he was a member of the Klan. And 2 years later, he just reappeared. I mean, he had tats everywhere. And he decided to get out of the Klan. and he had death threats. His mom had been threatened, and his daughter was back in his life. But he had nothing to do with her because she had had a baby by black man. And here this guy comes, big burly guy, with this little grandbaby, biracial grandbaby, and he was like a changed person. I mean, changed person. One lady lost her husband, kid, and niece in a car accident. I mean, these people just sharing things that, you know, they didn't have to. And it just gave me, kept making me look at myself and say, come on, man, pull it together, pull it together, pull it together. So I guess out of everything, it was a matter of you're responsible for what you know and what you don't know, and you're also responsible for where you are and where you want to go. There's going to be a lot of signs along the way, a lot of signs along the way, a lot of people along the way that are going to be for you to get to that spot and against you getting to that spot. But you have to choose wisely and really, really listen. And I'm not saying you're going to make it's going to be a smooth ride, but it's been an interesting trip, very interesting trip. So,
community listening to you is why I do this and why I do these podcasts, and that's because in each human being that I meet, when I first met you, I sensed that there was something that I could learn from you, and that's why I listened so intently.
Oh,
because I saw a man who was kind, a man who had been through a lot in his own life, and here was standing as a testament, not bitter. I felt no bitterness from you. I didn't even sense the why me. So that part of the vow. But I've learned a lot from you, and I think that this sharing of your life has been extremely enlightening, and I'm so honored that you took the time to do this with me, and I appreciate
it. I'm the one that's honored that you asked for me to talk about this. I mean, I grew up in segregation. I know what segregation is like, and I'm saying this for the time, sort of like for the time we're going through now, but I've had people who have used the N-word around me and turn around and reach in their pocket and say, here, go and do this. You're always welcome in my house. But they've used that word, and I find it very offensive, and I could never understand why they would use that word. And so I know what it's like to not be liked. I know what it's like to be different. And I always wanted to work past that. I didn't want to be that. I always, one of the things going to churches and exploring was that I always felt that we're all from the same pit, and that the only thing that's different is our skin color. But you close your eyes, and I cut you, and they cut me. You don't know whose blood is who until you open your eyes.
All right.
So, you know, I love people. I just love people. Faith has brought me to life.
Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for asking me.
On behalf of Integrity in Action, we want to thank you for listening to Integrity in Action with Lois Shulman. Join us monthly the third Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For more information on guests, your host, Lois Shulman, please visit BodyMindSpiritRadio.com to visit the Integrity in Action show page. Until next time, good night.